Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll hear from Secretary of State Adrian Fontes on yesterday's election operations and preparations for November. And ASU researchers are trying to find a new way to make pain meds that are less addictive than opioids. But first, Arizonans headed to the polls yesterday, and the results are rolling in this morning. Some races are still too close to call based on the preliminary results, but there are quite a few where the likely winners are clear. And here to talk about some of the biggest ones are both Cameron Sanchez and Wayne Shutsky from our politics desk. Good morning to you both. Are you awake?
A little bit.
A little bit, yes. Not much sleep, I'm sure, but thank you for coming in. Cameron, I want to start with you and the top of the ticket yesterday, the U.S. Senate primaries. Democrat Ruben Gallego ran unopposed, and I think most politicos expected Republican Kari Lake to beat out Pinal County Sheriff Mark Lamb for the GOP nomination. But talk about the results. How much did she win by?
Well, she did indeed take it, but she only got 50-something percent of the vote, which for that primary race was maybe not nearly as good as people expected her to do or hoped that she would do who are supporting her, because going into this general election, she's going to face off against Gallego, and that's going to be pretty competitive. So it would be better for her to start off with a really solid base of the Republican Party, like 70-something percent would have been great for her in the primary election. And hopefully for her, you know, those Republicans who voted for Lamb will come over and support her. She had sort of a unifying message last night. She said that he's a friend. She doesn't see him as a competitor. He's a friend of hers. And it's all about supporting Trump and going on together.
Unifying. Okay. Let's move on down the ballot, talk about some of the big congressional races and who is coming out on top this morning. Wayne, I want to start in Scottsdale District 1, where Amish Shaw leads a crowded slate of Democrats who are vying to go up against the Republican incumbent here, David Schweikert. By how much is he leading right now?
Shaw has held on to about a quarter of the vote, about 24%, ever since votes started rolling in. It's still too close to call, given that Andre Cherney trails by about 3% at this point. But I will say that Shaw's lead in that race has held steady as more votes come in. No one's really been able to eat too much into that.
Okay, so more votes to be counted there. Cameron, another big Democratic race in Phoenix, District 3. Though whoever wins the seat seems like they're probably going to keep it for some time. We had two major candidates duking it out, former Phoenix Vice Mayor Yasemin Ansari, former state lawmaker Raquel Teran. And Ansari is on top at this point.
She is. Last I checked, it was about 46% of the vote. And that's not huge, but if it holds, Ansari is most likely going to be the congresswoman because it's a very heavily Democratic Phoenix district.
Mm-hmm. Is this surprising, given there was a big recent controversy we had you on, I think, last week to talk about over a whole lot of money donated to Ansari's campaign from this pro-cryptocurrency PAC, right?
Right. And in that discussion, I said that initially I thought Teran was probably going to be the front runner when I first heard about who was going to be in this race. But throughout it, Ansari has been right there with her, and she raised a lot of money. So the scandal, if you want to call it that, with the PAC clearly didn't affect people's votes enough. I mean, it's impressive.
Yeah. Wayne, let's talk about the race to replace outgoing Congresswoman Debbie Lesko in the West Valley. This largely had become a pretty nasty race between attorney Abe Hamadeh and venture capitalist Blake Masters. Who's ahead right now? It's pretty close still.
It's pretty close, but again, like the race in CD1, Hamadeh has held the lead since votes started coming in. He has about a 4.5% lead over Blake Masters right now, and yeah, that hasn't really changed as votes come in. Both guys had a lot of name recognition after losing statewide elections in the last cycle. It's a lot easier to win in a congressional race, especially like CD8 with a captive Republican audience, just like CD3 for Democrats. CD8, whoever wins in this primary is almost guaranteed the seat.
Yeah, yeah. But this comes after this sort of odd thing happened in this race, right, where we had a last-minute kind of double endorsement from Donald Trump?
Yeah, Donald Trump endorsed both candidates in their statewide races back in 2022.
Right.
This time around, he pretty early on came out in favor of Hamadeh back in December. And then over the weekend, he was like, oh, Blake Masters, you have my endorsement too. And I read this more as Trump hedging to make sure that he could say he backed the winner because it was really too late in the game, given when early votes are coming in and all that, to really affect the outcome of the race.
Right. So much of this is early ballots. Have those been counted at this point? We're mostly looking at results from early ballots first thing, right?
A lot of the first round of early ballots that were turned in well ahead of time have come in. I believe we'll be speaking with the Secretary of State later. He can provide more details on that. But yeah, and then we saw the election day of votes come in after that, and then we have kind of the tail end trickling in now.
Okay. Let's spend a few minutes then talking about some county level races that could be very consequential. Many of those became about election integrity, election denialism. The biggest one a lot of folks were watching across the country even was Stephen Richards' race to keep his seat as Maricopa County Recorder. It's looking like he will lose.
Yeah, he is trailing Justin Heap. The AP has actually called the race in favor of Heap, so a state lawmaker who has, we'll say, dabbled in the election denial movement. He won't come right out and say whether he thinks certain elections were stolen in the past, but he is part of a crowd of lawmakers at the Capitol who are big fans of former President Donald Trump and many of his compatriots in that wing repeat those claims. And in addition, a third candidate, Don Hyatt, also took about 21% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So if we're really looking at it, folks from that kind of election that was stolen wing of the party took about 60% of the vote in this race.
Wow. What about at the County Board of Supervisors, where there were several kind of challengers from the right hoping to unseat incumbents who largely, you know, defended the integrity of the last election? This became a big battle kind of within the GOP. Did they win?
Kind of. So we're going to have some new people. Yeah. So Tom Galvin kept his seat against Eugene T. Rita, who I'd say Thomas Galvin is more of the non-MAGA candidate in that race. And he did pretty well. Mm-hmm. But Jack Sellers fell behind. And that's another Republican incumbent. And then there were two races. Debbie Lesko looks like she's taking it quite handily.
Left her congressional seat right now, running for the Board of Supervisors.
And then Kate Brophy McGee, who's a former lawmaker, looks like she'll be coming into a pretty handy win as well for the board. So looks like some new people ousting the board, who's been very staunchly clear that the elections are safe and secure in Maricopa County and have faced a lot of vitriol for that stance.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to take a minute or two here to talk about the state legislature. There were a lot of races in both the state Senate, the state House here, primaries. But let's just touch on a few big ones and interesting ones. Cameron, you were watching a Tucson Senate race that got pretty contentious, especially in the last week or so. We're seeing Republican Senator Justine Wadsack a little behind at this point.
Yes, and she's currently losing to former state senator Vince Leach. So she took his seat in the last election, and now he's trying to take it back from her. And there was a lot of drama. This was a heated campaign. He ran a lot of attacks against her. And, you know, as a freshman lawmaker, she's made a lot of headlines with controversial bills, and most recently with this whole speeding ticket issue down in the Tucson area.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a victory for Leach potentially.
Okay.
Ousting an incumbent.
And Wayne, another potential ouster here. It's looking like Republican Senator Ken Bennett, who was sort of a swing vote at the Capitol last session and has been in the state government for a long time, is losing to Mark Fincham.
Yeah, he's losing pretty handedly. Mark Fincham, a former state lawmaker from southern Arizona, who then lost a bid for Secretary of State. Another one of these folks very heavily entrenched in the election was stolen from Donald Trump movement. Mm-hmm. You know, campaigns on that, goes on podcasts, all this kind of stuff, drumming up those type of conspiracy theories. He's winning by well over 10% over Bennett, who you know, Bennett he's been at the legislature back and forth a long time. He's a former Secretary of State, like you said, kind of seen as a swing vote down there, but also has a kind of a checkered history himself with some of these things. He was, you know, part of the group that was questioning former President Obama's birth certificate. He was the liaison for the Senate audit. So, but ultimately, yes, he's not really beloved by the MAGA wing of the party, and it looks like Fincham used that to his advantage. He moved out of Tucson up to northern Arizona, and looks like he's headed back to the legislature.
Wow. Okay. So final question for you both in the last minute or so here. Is there a theme from last night that you are taking away heading into November? Wayne, you want to start here?
Yeah. And I think we talked a lot about some of these kind of MAGA election stolen candidates winning out in some of these very key races. But a lot of these ones, they're not guaranteed wins. You know, when people say Arizona's a swing state, I don't know. It depends on where you are in the state. But Maricopa County is definitely a swing state. So someone like Justin Heap, who has defeated Stephen Richer, is going to be running against a Democrat in a county that has elected Democrats to statewide races. Mark Stewart, who defeated Jack Sellers for the Board of Supervisors, is running in a district Sellers won by, I believe, only a few hundred votes in his last election over a Democrat. So, you know, a lot of these are hardly givens at this point.
Interesting. Okay. Cameron.
Well, with a few exceptions, like the ones we just mentioned with Bennett and Wadsack, I'd say that incumbents did pretty well in the legislative races. And yeah, I wouldn't discount those general elections, because even those are going to be pretty insane in some of those districts, like Bullock going up against Schwiebert in the North Phoenix area.
Lots to watch for. Okay. KJZZ's Politics Desk, all in the studio today. Cameron Sanchez, Wayne Shetsky. Thank you both, as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Go get some coffee. Elections operations went pretty smoothly for the most part yesterday, a stark change from recent elections in the past, and the result of a whole lot of preparation by county and state election officials. Here in our studio to talk about all of it is Secretary of State Adrian Fontes. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So things went pretty well yesterday, very different than we were where we were the last election. Are you relieved?
Not really relieved. I mean, we kind of saw this coming. We started getting ready for this cycle back in January of 2023 when I took the Secretary of State's office. We made some significant adjustments in our training. We really worked hard with the counties to get them the resources that we needed. So this is the result of that proper prior preparation that we learned, what I learned about in the Marine Corps. So I think things are going pretty well.
Lots of preparation. We did see one sort of odd issue with erasable ink come up on a very small number of ballots yesterday. What happened?
Well, this actually is a testament to how well we are paying attention to every single ballot, right? If we identified possibly up to 30 ballots statewide that may have had ink that could fade given too much heat, we saw this issue in some of our mail-in ballots and we thought, you know what, let's put out a notice and figure out how we're going to deal with this. And we have sort of contingencies for all kinds of things, including, it turns out, disappearing ink.
And you had a contingency for this.
Yeah. I mean, and this is really sort of, you know, and people don't think about these things, but we do. I think we were quick to let folks know that this might be an issue. But if you think about it really carefully, based on the enormous volume of ballots that come through our systems across the state, the fact that we noticed this issue and the fact that we were able to address it really is a testament to the professionalism of the county election departments across Arizona. So kudos to them.
Okay. But speaking of enormous numbers of ballots, this is just a primary. Turnout kind of hovers around 30 some percent usually here. How many more voters are you expecting come November when Arizona is this crucial swing state? We've got a presidential race on the ticket, Senate races, all these big things.
Yeah, I won't be surprised if we hit nearly three times the number of voters. So we should get north of about 80% full turnout, I think, maybe closer to 90%, given the excitement that we're seeing, particularly because of some of the shifting of late. I think both of the bases are fired up a little more than they were, and we always see this in presidential cycles. But, you know, the numbers were right about where they've always been for primaries in Arizona. You know, we've gotten anywhere down to from 29% to about 35% over the last five or six cycles. And so this is right about where we've always been. And again, we have always done about the same in Arizona. People react differently, especially over the last few years. But pretty much this business remains pretty solid and pretty steady.
Are you ready when it comes to elections operations for November, when really like all eyes will be on Arizona and not just on results, but how things go at the polls?
Absolutely. We're not just ready, but I think in some people would say we're going a little too far in some of our preparations. But that's good, right? We need to be ready for just about anything. The world of election administration took a significant turn in January of 2017 when we were declared critical infrastructure by the Department of Homeland Security. And so we had this entirely different perspective on the business that we had to inject into our planning. And so we've taken that posture and we've run with it. And it has helped us a lot. We got past that CrowdStrike or Cloudflare or whatever that software thing was very quickly. In fact, Arizona's Department of State was the first state agency to identify the issue. We're the ones who notified the Department of Administration and Arizona's Department of Homeland Security. We had completely ameliorated the problem in our office by noon the next day. So, you know, we've been really, really good at preparing. And I feel really confident in the work that the counties have been doing across the state.
Yeah. Last minute or two here. I want to ask you about a few races we just discussed with our politics desk
sure.
that have to do with elections, the County Board of Supervisors, the County Recorder's race with Stephen Richer. Election denialism still remains strong, as I'm sure you're aware, in much of the electorate. What do you think this means and the makeup of these offices could potentially mean for the future of your work?
Well, look, what we've seen in Arizona, and based on my experience, is occasionally we'll get someone who comes into an election administration office, and they might have a history of speaking out against the integrity or the veracity of our elections. But as soon as they come into these offices and they start seeing the work that's done, they start seeing the checks and balances and understanding more and more of the processes, they turn around. And we've seen this in several of Arizona's counties so far. We've got great partners with very diverse political viewpoints. But at the end of the day, I think once people realize what the work entails and how solid our processes are, they come around. And so I hope that thinking folks, regardless of their political affiliation or their current opinions, will take the time to ask the questions and listen. And hopefully they'll serve our voters well.
What about poll workers? This has been a big issue, getting enough poll workers, protecting them, security issues there. What do your preparations look like there? Will you have enough?
Well, look, enough is one thing, and we're always looking for more folks. Every county election department is responsible for that. So if you're interested in being a poll worker, we absolutely hope that you will go to your county election department and let them know. They're always recruiting more folks so that we can have backups and so forth. But we are keeping them safe. We are making sure that things are working really well. And I think yesterday is a testament to that. And while we may have had smaller turnout, pretty much really smooth sailing across the entire state.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly here real quickly about the elections procedures manual that your office released and is now facing some legal challenges. One of the judges in one of those cases weighed in this week saying she was concerned that changes your office made would infringe on First Amendment rights. What's your response?
My response is that not all speech is protected speech. And sometimes when you say things, those things might actually be crimes. And number one, the regulations that we try to put forward protect voters when they go out to vote from people who want to intimidate them. And so when it comes down to it, I certainly do think we need to be very careful when it comes to talking about the First Amendment. But the First Amendment doesn't protect you from yelling fire in a movie theater. It also shouldn't protect you from trying to intimidate voters away from exercising their constitutional rights.
All right. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, exploring Arizona's most iconic landmark on foot.
You will spend so much time bushwhacking through the backcountry, moving up and down the walls of the canyon to piece together a route along the very thin ledges and terraces that you move across, taking these enormous detours into side canyons, more than 600 of them that you have to thread into and then back out of.
We'll hear from an author about his 750-mile trek through the Grand Canyon. But first, election results coming in today are giving us a clearer sense of what candidates might be on our November ballots. So let's take a few minutes now to talk some about some of the other issues that will likely be there for voters to weigh in on, namely a long list of ballot measures, some referred by voters and others sent to the ballot by Republican state lawmakers bypassing the governor's veto. There will be a host of measures for us to consider in the fall, but at this point, many of them are still mired in court challenges and legal fights over how they will be worded on the ballot. And here to give us an update on some of the biggest ones is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. If we weren't fighting in court, what would we be doing?
That's a very good question. All right. Let's start with the abortion access measure that has gathered so many signatures and would expand abortion rights in our state. GOP state lawmakers use the term unborn human being in the language to describe what the measure would do. But a judge has rejected this term this week.
The judge said this is hardly impartial, that there is no medical term unborn human being. You know, doctors admitted they might use that. If you're talking to a woman who is in her pregnancy, you wanted to talk to her about stopping smoking, stopping drug use, you might say, you know, your unborn child or something like that. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about a ballot measure, as far as what can be done and when a woman can terminate a pregnancy, the judge said, no, it's simple. It is an embryo or a fetus. And he sent it back to the Legislative Council, a group of lawmakers controlled by Republicans, to go back and do it right. He didn't tell them you have to use the word fetus. He said you just can't use those words. Now, remember, this is one of only two challenges to this whole abortion measure. You also have something playing out in court this Friday, the charge by Arizona Right to Life that the measure is so inherently misleading and flawed that it is not in any suitable way, shape to go to the voters. And they want a judge to throw it off the ballot entirely. I'm not sure a judge is going to buy it. She may say, look, there may be words in there that are controversial, but voters have a chance to read it and let them decide.
Mm-hmm. So right, two legal challenges there. The first one you talked about is now heading to the state Supreme Court, yeah?
Yes, that'll be at the Supreme Court. We're waiting for the justices to rule on that. As I mentioned, the other one is up on Friday in the Superior Court. And of course, as with all these measures, whoever loses in Superior Court will take it to the Supreme Court. Nothing is simple here.
It all ends up there. Okay. Another ballot measure that's also under consideration, as we said, at the state Supreme Court. This one about the so-called Secure the Border Act. This was sent by lawmakers to the ballot after the governor vetoed it or something very similar. And it's being challenged for a different reason, it sounds like.
This comes down to a single subject issue. The Constitution says that all legislation, including legislation either proposed by the legislature to go to the ballot or by initiative supporters themselves, should stick to a single subject and matters properly connected therewith. That's the wording of the law. Now, it's very clear that you've got a measure in there. The prime purpose is to allow state and local police to go ahead and arrest people that they say have crossed the border other than at a port of entry. There are some semi-related things in terms of denying public benefits to people who are here illegally who use fraudulent papers. Mm-hmm. The real sticking point is a new measure on what they call lethal fentanyl use, and that anybody who sells fentanyl that causes the death of another person would be subject to a mandatory presumptive 10-year term, which is double with the standard term. The argument is, what does this have to do with the border? Particularly since the people who can be arrested in this do not have to be people who are here illegally. It applies to U.S. citizens. Mm. Now, a trial judge said, well, you know, fentanyl does come across the border, even if all of it doesn't. And so, you know, the legislature decided this is all part of a single border problem of people smuggling. Now this goes to the Supreme Court. Again, you know, back to our basic premise that everything ends up at the Supreme Court, and they will decide, is this too broad? Now, here's a really interesting thing about the way the Arizona law works. If the court decides that one or more measures are not related, they don't have the power to excise out the stuff they say is unrelated. The whole measure fails. Mm. It does not go to the ballot.
That's interesting. And we've seen, you know, ballot measures fail because of this single subject rule before, right?
Exactly. And, you know, the court has had various theories about what's a single subject. At one time, it was what they call log rolling. In other words, if you want Part A, but to get Part A, you have to vote for Part B because of the fact that it's all a package. The court said, no, that's not proper. Mm-hmm. They've kind of loosened up on that. Again, it comes down to what is a single subject and things that are necessary as part of a whole.
Okay. All right. So lastly here, Howie, let's quickly round up some challenges that the other two voter initiatives are facing on their way to the ballot. We've got one aimed at raising the state's minimum wage to $18 an hour, and it's being challenged by the Arizona Restaurant Association. Is that right?
Exactly. You know, their argument is that margins are already pretty tight. Plus, the other thing that concerns them is right now there is a tipped worker credit. In other words, right now the minimum wage is $14.35 an hour, but restaurants need only pay their workers $3 an hour less as long as with the tips it gets up to $14. Mm-hmm. This measure also would eliminate that tip worker credit over the next 3 years, so the restaurants would be liable for the whole $18. Now, note the Restaurant Association got the legislature to put a competing measure on the ballot that says that if there's a Tip Worker Protection Act, it actually can increases to 25%. So you've got, you know, nothing that's clear there.
Another challenge here, this is another voter initiative that would institute open primaries, essentially, in the state. Who's challenging this one in court?
Well, actually, it's interesting because it seems to be being challenged by both sides. You've got Republican interests and Democratic interests, which suggests that the folks, you know, in the political parties like the system the way it is. They get to choose who they want in the primaries, and that tends to be the folks who are more the red meat crowd for the Democrats or the Republicans. They're arguing that it violates a single subject rule. And there are, in fact, multiple changes in there in terms of how the primary would be run, open primary, the possibility of a ranked choice voting for the general election, no matter how many people advance, various other issues there. But here again, the legislature, the Republican-controlled legislature, put its own competing measure on the ballot that cements in the right into the Constitution to go ahead and have every party name its own candidates. So it's going to be really confusing in terms of, well, which open primary measure do I like and which one do I not like?
Man, oh, man. Okay. A lot to think about heading toward November and more to report there. Howie Fisher, Capital Media Services. Thanks as always. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Researchers at ASU were trying to come up with a new way to make pain medication that would be less addictive than opioids and would also not make patients feel cold. And they're using a specific protein to try to do that. Wade Van Horn is a professor in ASU's School of Molecular Sciences and Biodesign Center for Personalized Diagnostics. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked what exactly he was trying to figure out with this research.
Yeah, so I've been fascinated for a number of years. So you and I, we interact with our environment and we need to know kind of are things hot or cold. And that has a lot of implications in both, you know, are we cold and do we need to warm up, or are we hot and do we need to cool down? But so my lab's been studying the cold sensing protein in humans, which has a funny name called TRPM8, for a number of years now. And we were really interested in, could we understand a way that maybe we could turn this into a drug target for new kinds of pain therapies?
What led you to think that was even something that you should be thinking about?
Well, so many kinds of pain are associated with this receptor, this protein TRPM8, this cold receptor. And so, for example, if you touch something really cold, it feels like it's burning and it hurts. But there's a number of other kinds of pains that are known to be associated with it. And they vary widely from things like migraine headaches to neuropathic pain, you know, where maybe you get injured and then you have kind of pains for long term, or things like diabetics often have neuropathic pain. And so it's been known that TRPM8 is involved in pain for a number of years. And so we wanted to see if we could help understand how and maybe come up with ideas to target it more effectively.
Well, so what might that look like in terms of trying to target more effectively and maybe use it to our advantage?
Yeah, so one of the things that's made targeting TRPM8 difficult is that it's sensitive to both cold, but also to chemicals. And so if you think about, say, the mint plant, it has a chemical called menthol. And menthol actually induces the same kind of cold feeling that cold does through this exact same receptor. And so some drug companies have tried to target TRPM8 for pain, and they've found that it's very effective at inhibiting certain kinds of pain, but there's a side effect. And that side effect often is that you feel cold and patients don't tolerate that well. So we wanted to see if we could understand the side effect and maybe come up with a new way to screen new kinds of drugs.
So does that mean that for at least some patients, if they are on some of these medications aimed at helping dull their pain, as a side effect, they might end up feeling cold?
Yeah. So, you know, most commonly people are taking, you know, for chronic pain, things like opioids, right, which have, you know, tremendous side effects. So people are on the lookout for new kinds of pain targets that don't have the same kinds of side effects as opioids, like addiction. So in theory, if one were to be able to target TRPM8, it wouldn't be addictive. And so then that would alleviate a lot of societal problems that are, you know, surround opioids and opioid addiction.
So I guess that means the big question is how do you actually do that? How do you develop an effective pain medication that does that?
Yeah, so one of the things that's known is, like I said, when you target TRPM8, it might cause you not to feel cold. both just, you know, if you stuck your hand in an ice bucket kind of thing, but also it could change your body temperature, both of which could be dangerous. And so we wanted to see, could we use modern science to decouple or separate these kinds of features of TRPM8? And so how we went about doing it is using a funny technique called ancestral protein reconstruction.
And what does that mean?
So, yeah, I think the easiest way to think about it is imagine that, you know, you have your great, great, great grandmother's chocolate chip cookie recipe.
Okay.
And it's changed over time, perhaps. So what you did is you got all the recipes from all your cousins and aunts and uncles. And maybe with all of those, you could kind of recapitulate what the original chocolate chip cookie recipe was. So that's kind of what we did for TRPM8, is we looked at sequences for humans and rats and monkeys and kind of every organism we could find. And we could use then mathematics to predict what ancestral TRPM8 sequences were. And we could study those. So we could resurrect those and study those. And we found effectively that we could separate out the cold sensing aspect of TRPM8 from the chemical sensing aspect of TRPM8.
So it sounds like what you came up with was kind of an amalgam of all sorts of different TRPM8s.
Yeah. Well, so what we came up with was, yeah, a predecessor TRPM8. So that's right. So the way, you know, it's a funny bit of biochemistry and mathematics and evolutionary theory. But based on that, we can kind of track back along evolution and then say, what was TRPM8 like back then? And then we can study that and we can go back further or closer. And with those kinds of studies, we can then try and understand, you know, is this cold sensitive? Is this menthol sensitive? Is it both? And accordingly, we were able to kind of say, hey, look, here's an ancestral TRPM8 that's sensitive to cold. Oh, and here's one that's sensitive to menthol or chemicals. And now that puts us in a position where, in theory, we should be able to screen drugs against both of these and find one that can inhibit the chemical activation but leave the cold activation alone.
Well, so you mentioned that you can do that in theory. In practice, how easy or difficult might that be to achieve, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on at what level. So, you know, my lab is set up with instruments that we can assess this in a very high throughput way. And so it should be straightforward to, you know, identify candidate drugs that will be selective for one activation mode over the other. Of course, that's just the start of the drug discovery pathway, right? And so then it's many years to make sure it's safe, that it's effective, you know, in the clinic. So, you know, I think that the starting point, it's obvious what to do and it's pretty straightforward. But again, it's a time-consuming process to eventually get something in the clinic.
Well, and as you referenced, it sounds like the goal here is to be able to develop a medication that treats pain without being addictive and without some of the side effects, for example, making patients feel like they're cold.
That's what we hope we can do. Yeah, is that, you know, and this is a funny, using this so-called ancestral sequence reconstruction is a really different way to do it. But yeah, I think, you know, we'll start now finding different kinds of drug candidates and looking for ones that have the right properties. And, you know, if we're successful, then we should be able to come up with, you know, alternatives to opioids and things that, you know, are non-addictive, but effectively treat pain.
All right. That is Wade Van Horn, a professor in ASU School of Molecular Sciences and Biodesign Center for Personalized Diagnostics. Wade, thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, too.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Flagstaff author Kevin Fidarko spent the better part of 6 years as an apprentice river guide along the Colorado River in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He studied the culture of people who are transfixed by the river and the art of rowing down it. He even wrote a book about it called The Emerald Mile. But his newest book, A Walk in the Park, presented him with an entirely different view of the canyon. I spoke with him more about it.
In the summer of 2015, my friend and collaborator, Peter McBride, National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, came to me with a rather harebrained idea. And he said, look, I know that you know the world of the river at the bottom of the canyon, but what we're going to do as an assignment for National Geographic magazine is we're going to strap 55-pound packs on our backs, and we're going to walk through the canyon on foot. We're going to walk along the length of the canyon, starting at Lee's Ferry, ending at the Grand Wash Cliffs, and we're going to do that together despite the fact that there is no trail that you can follow through Grand Canyon National Park. So that's how the whole thing started, and the misery and the brutality and the suffering that ensued from it was really the dominant theme, at least for the beginning part of the journey that followed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this has been called the toughest hike in the world. Is that right? Like, I mean, no trail is like an understatement.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it is one of, if not the toughest hikes in the world. I mean, it's the second most visited national park in America. It's got 6 million people that come to it each and every year. The only park that receives more visitation is Great Smoky Mountains National Park back east. Mm-hmm. And most people who go into the canyon and through the canyon, they use the only highway that's really available. It's the Colorado River. It's the instrument that carved and created and polished the canyon in the first place. And a river trip is a wonderful way to experience Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Colorado River travels about 277 miles as it moves through the bottom of Grand Canyon. But if you are moving through this landscape on foot, you have to keep in mind, this is probably the most shattered, broken, fragmented landscape feature on the face of the North American continent. And you will spend so much time bushwhacking through the backcountry, moving up and down the walls of the canyon to piece together a route along the very thin ledges and terraces that you move across, taking these enormous detours into side canyons, more than 600 of them that you have to thread into and then back out of, that on foot, you're not going to cover 277 miles. You're going to cover about 750 miles.
Wow.
So that is just an incredibly difficult thing to do from a physical standpoint.
Yeah. So you enlisted like a group of more experienced hikers, it sounds like, to let you tag along, at least on the first part of this journey. Talk about how you began, your expectations, the things that you even tried to bring, right?
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, but there's just no way of getting around it. Pete and I did not prepare adequately for this trip. We assumed that we knew the Grand Canyon by virtue of our familiarity with the river.
Yeah.
We figured, how hard can it really be? And so we were not in the kind of physical shape that we needed to be in to be able to carry these enormous packs up and down the walls of the canyon for 8 or 10 hours a day. We didn't know what to bring in terms of the discipline and the hard choices that you have to make between what you think you want inside of the canyon and what you really need in order to survive. Mm-hmm. The only thing that we did that was a good decision was we convinced a group of very, very experienced long-distance hikers who had embarked on their own continuous through hike to let us tag along for the first part of our first segment. And I have to tell you that, you know, it took the canyon just 5 days to break Pete and I in half. Mm. By that point, the bottoms of my feet were covered in so many blisters, it looked as if I'd been given a pedicure with a belt sander.
Oof.
Pete had succumbed to a brutal heat condition known as hyponatremia, which arises from a severe deficiency in electrolytes and which, if untreated, can kill you. Mm. And we had to claw our way out of the canyon, abandon this group of hikers that had taken us under their wing, come back to Flagstaff with our tails between our legs, and acknowledge that we had failed, and that if we wanted to complete this journey through the canyon, we were going to have to really restart the whole process and prepare adequately
Wow.
for the venture.
Right. And you write about this pretty brutally in the book, but there's an excerpt I would love for you to read from when you first arrived there, before you kind of realized how terrible this was going to be and what you saw. It was at night. Can you read that for us?
Absolutely. We pulled off the pavement and followed a set of tire tracks leading through clumps of salt brush and rabbit brush, interspersed with the occasional yucca. It was pitch dark when we finally reached the end of the road, killed the headlights, and gasped in awe as we stepped from the truck. The Milky Way shimmered across the heavens from one horizon to the other, and the rest of the sky was speckled with so many constellations that I felt dizzy and was forced to look away. which is when my eye caught the flicker of a small campfire about 20 yards in front of us. Amid the orange glow, I could see the silhouettes of Rich and his crew of hikers set against the star-dappled immensity of the night.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's this immense beauty at the same time that you also really capture. And obviously you love the Grand Canyon. You spent a lot of time there, you know, maybe not in this way, but on the river, right? Talk a little bit about the balance of those two things. Like, were you surprised that this place that you love so much could tear you apart like this?
I was, and you've put your finger on a really salient truth, which is that, you know, to move through this landscape on foot is to experience a kind of unending river of suffering and hardship, but punctuated with moments of extraordinary beauty, revelation, epiphany, insight, wonder, and magic. I mean, there are wonders tucked inside the folds of the canyon that are invisible from the rims where most people go to look into the abyss, and also invisible from the river. And those places are places that very, very few people get to set foot in or lay eyes on. There are places where you find tiny springs bubbling from the rock that are capable of supporting up to 500 times the density of flora and fauna that flourishes in the surrounding desert landscapes. And then, of course, there is the pageantry of light that unfolds each and every day as the sunlight plays along the walls of the canyon, those 26 separate layers of rock arrayed in horizontal strata, each a different color and texture. And the walls can take on, you know, the appearance of a painting by, say, Monet or Van Gogh, depending on what hour of the day and what type of weather you're gazing at on. It's just a wondrous, magical, extraordinary place that has no analog anywhere on Earth.
Let me ask you lastly, Kevin, about finishing it, right? Like about 750 miles. This took you, you know, more than a year. When you were done, what was your reaction? Like, did you expect to ever make it?
When we were finished, I was immensely relieved. I felt as if nothing could be more difficult or arduous or painful than the physical act of hiking from one end of the canyon to the other. And then I sat down to try and write the book that would tell the story, not just of what happened to us, but the history of the landscape, the history of the native tribes who were part of this park before it became a park, the issues that loom over this landscape and the importance of protecting it as one of the great wonders of this country. And that process, the process of putting all of that down on the page, that took 7 years, and it was far more difficult and painful than the hike itself.
I guess that makes sense. But it's out, and it's lovely. Congratulations on that. And Kevin Fedarko, author of A Walk in the Park, joining us. Thank you so much, Kevin. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Today is the last day of July. What a July it's been, by the way, which means we have another monthly playlist out on Spotify for your listening pleasure. We've had a lot of good music on the show this month. We always get a lot of requests from folks asking what that song was that we played. We've heard Charlie XCX, Olympic Fanfare, and more. You can find all of that and more in our July playlist. Just search KJZZ's The Show on Spotify. And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. We will be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more, as always. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. That's where all the cool kids are. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, Gabriella Fernbaugh, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about story ideas, things that are happening in your part of the valley. We are at the show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.